Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Friday afternoon at 2pm on BCFM 93.2. This week, Matthew Derrick's with me. We'll be talking about the ATOS assessments and how it affects some disabled people. Also, more too with Peruvian-born genius documentary filmmaker Alan Frankovich, who died in mysterious circumstances at Houston Airport Customs Hall back in 1997. He documented black operations under the secret orders of prime ministers, presidents and royalty. And staying with our original disabled theme, our weekly news and disabled people's update with Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So straight away, let's have a chat to Matthew Derrick. Hi, Matthew, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, hello.
First of all, Matthew, you know, you've been through some of the notorious ATOS assessments. Mm-hmm. But how did you first become disabled? I know you worked for FedEx here in Bristol. Whereabouts was that?
That was in Avonmouth.
Okay. What kind of work was that then? I mean, FedEx are one of these kind of people who've sort of taken over, haven't they, a little bit from the post office. They're doing that sort of work. Is that right?
Yeah. It was for ANC when I first started, and then FedEx came and took over. I was basically unloading lorries, pallets with a forklift, putting it on the floor, and it would be stripped down and put onto the smaller vans for deliveries around the Bristol area.
Okay, so you were at one of these kind of points of distribution, so stuff mm-hmm. was coming from all other parts of the country.
Yeah, all around the world.
To you, and yep. you were picking out with a forklift truck and kind of splitting it up for yep. local deliveries. All right, so that's at Avonmouth. Tell us, what exactly you were doing sort of day-to-day with your forklift truck, because that's how you got your injury, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they didn't really... The ground outside was very rough. There's loads of potholes, and on the way in and out the warehouse, there was it was like a curb. It was about a 3-inch curb. Now on a forklift, there's no suspension, and it's got solid tyres.
Why is that?
It's just the way they're designed. I mean, on modern ones, there's a suspension in the seat, like an air suspension.
Ah, right, I see what you mean.
But
yeah.
on this was an old one, so there was none of that, and. It used to jar my back driving in and out of the warehouse. I mean, you know, I brought cushions in to try to soften it. I wore a weightlifting belt to try to give my back support.
How would a weightlifting belt help you?
Well, just a bit of support. The seat was, ripped, and, you know, all the foam had, you know, basically disappeared over the years. It was
so you're basically sitting almost on the metal of the
I may as well have been, yeah.
Without any suspension, connected straight to
yeah,
the ground.
Yeah, and it was going straight up my back.
So, I mean, this might sound like a bit of a crazy question, but how many times a day were you having to go backwards and forwards across this 3-inch curb?
Say 50 times a morning, yeah, 50 times.
Right, so that every time that happens, that's kind of sending a bit of a jolt, isn't it, right through you?
Yeah, and I spoke to my surgeon, and he said that it would weaken the sides of the discs and push the disc out through the walls, and it's called a prolapse disc then.
Oh, nasty. Well, anyway, just give us an idea of how long you were actually doing that job for.
I was down there for six to seven years.
So that's from about 2004 right up to about 2010, is that roughly right?
Yeah.
Okay, so when did you first start to feel... Okay, so you're yourself taking responsibility for trying to deal with the pain was coming along. I mean, how did any of that work? Did it actually help you?
No, I stopped using the forklift after, well, I mean, about 3 years, I was actually driving it non-stop. And I refused to drive it anymore.
Okay, so what time were you starting in the morning? What time were you finishing?
Half one. Starting at half one in the morning, and it was a job and knock. So sometimes we'd finish at half seven, sometimes eight, half eight. Yeah, it was. We wouldn't have any breaks. We just worked straight through.
Now, I mean, again, it might sound like a silly question, but you know, your back is shot after those 6 years working there. Mm. Did someone else just take over and sit in that same seat and
Yeah.
Really, crikey! Yeah. Well, that's awful. I mean, did you not get any support from the company FedEx whilst you were doing this?
No, they kicked me out. Basically, they waited. Until 3 years from the first time I asked my doctor, complained about a bad back.
Right, so this was, I mean, you had your first operation around about 2009, so was it,
yeah.
That's when you went to your doctor at about the same time, was it, or before that?
Before that, and I was having a bit of time off because of my back problem. They asked me for my medical records. I didn't know why. I didn't honestly know why they would want such a thing, because there wasn't a doctor working there. They didn't show them to a doctor. And then I realised that they wanted to find out when I had asked my doctor for support for my back, or, you know, some medication or something.
How did it actually affect you? I mean, when did you first realise that, you know, it wasn't just a little bit of a back pain, that this was something quite serious?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's ruined my life. I mean, you know, I was an active person, a very active person.
Were you a sporty type?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah. You know, I've never been, I've never been a lazy person. I've always worked.
I mean, what sort of sports did you do then? Or were you
I used to play rugby. Yeah.
Right. I mean, is it not possible that maybe the rugby, you got injuries during the rugby? Rugby's a bit of a rough and tumble sport, isn't it?
Yeah. I understand what you're saying, but I've never been injured on a rugby field. Not, you know, I mean, the odd scratch and bruise, but not with my back. And anyway, I was out on the wing. I used to leave the rough and tumble to the forwards. That weren't my job.
Okay, so did you find that you had to give up the rugby roughly the same time as the
work? No, years after. Yeah, I used to play rugby when I was, you know, in my early 20s. I mean, you know, I'm 43 now.
Okay, so you'd given up the rugby well before
but I'm still, you know, I'm still an active person. I'm not, you know,
I mean, the thing is, you say you're an active person, but with a back injury, it's not very easy to be active, is it?
And not now, no. I mean, I find it difficult getting out of bed in the morning. I mean, I've got to walk for at least half hour in the morning to loosen up my back. To, you know, it gets very stiff. It's like an unoiled hinge of a door. You know, it's got to be. I got to loosen it up, basically.
Okay. Well, we say you started with operations in 2009. How did that fit in with you losing your job? Was that at the same time or
after?
Okay. So you had a few operations.
Yeah, I had the first operation. I went back to work. It didn't help in any way, the first operation. It's called a microdiscectomy. It didn't help. I went back in 2010 and had a lumbar fusion, where they actually take the whole disc out and put, you know, bars and plates in, and they screw the two vertebrae together.
You're actually making my back hurt just saying this. It does, yes. So just take us through those various operations, and, you know, whether they managed to help you or not, because you had how many altogether?
Two, yeah.
All right.
Two operations.
So those two, did that help you after the second operation?
No. I mean, it helped. It was, and it's a lot better than what it was. I mean, I used to have sciatica.
What is sciatica?
It's where the sciatic nerve that runs down your left leg, the slip discs rubs on that nerve, and it sends like an electrical, it's like a shooting pain. It's like having cramp in your whole of your left leg. It's not as bad now. It's not as acute. I get it more in my calf, and my toes cramp up, you know, but not as regular as what it used to be. And, you know, it used to be my whole leg, you know, the whole of my left leg, and I couldn't sit on the toilet, I couldn't lay down in bed, I got to keep my left leg out straight, you know, on the way up here in the car. I don't know if you see me move the seat all the way back. Yeah.
Okay. So after your second operation, you lost your job. What was that? I mean, how did they break that to you at FedEx?
Well, as I said, they asked for my medical records. They said I had a couple of days off, a couple of nights off of work, and they said you can't come back unless we have a look at your medical records. And I couldn't understand why. And then a couple of months later, I got a written warning for something that was, you know, I'm not turning up for work. And I used to work, as I said, at 1:30 in the morning. So, I mean, we used to phone each other. If someone wasn't in for work, we'd phone and find out why they weren't in. This didn't happen. I slept through. There's, you know, it was my fault. But we never used to get written warnings for this kind of things. That's when I kind of knew that they wanted to get rid of me. But it wasn't until I had a look through my medical records and I seen that it was 3 years to the week that they sacked me. The first time I went to my doctor and asked for help for my back problem, 3 years to a week they sacked me. And apparently I couldn't claim for nothing because it had gone over this magical three-year period.
Right, so you think maybe that's why they sacked you, because they were looking back.
I'm sure.
They were looking back and thinking, well, if he stays on any longer, he may be able to do what? I mean, could you claim anything from them or what?
Well, I'm sure I could have. I mean, you know, the forklift was in a bad state. I mean, some people might think it was my fault because I shouldn't have got on the forklift if it went, you know, in a good state of repairs or whatever. But you know, this is work. I mean, I went in and someone would tell me what to do and I'd get on and do it, like, you know, and that's what I was getting paid for. I was getting paid to unload the lorries. That was the only forklift we had, so the alternative was to do it by hand. And
okay, so I mean, one of the things you said is you find it difficult to get up in the morning. That's you know, that's the sort of thing the government are accusing quite a lot of people who don't have jobs of. But for you, it's something different. It's actually physically.
I'm talking physically getting out of bed. Yeah,
just tell us what it's like. I mean, you know.
Well, I wake up. I've got to lay in bed and move my back to see if it's you know, free enough for me to swing my legs round, and then I've got to push myself up. You know, it's I've got it off to a fine art now. It's a routine, you know. It's the same with getting out the bath. It's the same with putting my shoes on and my socks on in the morning. Like, you know, you find a way of doing it that it don't hurt so much. I mean, it hurts. It's hurting me sat here now, but, you know. Yeah, it's just like a dull ache. I've got a dull ache all the time.
So have you actually managed to get work since you finished with FedEx?
No.
And have you tried? I mean, do you think it's possible for you to work? Because, I mean, you're in pain, you know.
Yeah, I've tried to do, like, you know, little bits here and there, but I find it difficult, like, doing the vacuuming. And I suppose, again, you could say this is probably my fault. After the second operation, I went straight back to work. Well, not straight back to work. I had about 2 months, you know, respite, and then went straight back to work. And I didn't go to physio, and I didn't do this. Maybe if I would have went to physio, had a bit more time off work, I might have, you know, got healed a bit better than what I have done. But,
I mean, do you ever find that you're actually flat out? I mean, I know some people with back problems.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah. I'm on the floor. I mean, you know, maybe. Once or twice a month, and it's just really, really stupid little things. Like, I could be walking my dog, he's on the lead, he stops all of a sudden to smell something, and my back's gone. You know, I've got to stand there for 20 minutes, slowly working it until and then limp back home. Like, you know, it can be, you know, vacuuming, washing up, you know, just turning round to answer the door. You know, it's become very, very delicate, my back. Yeah.
Okay, sounds to me like it's probably not a good idea for you to be certainly doing any kind of real physical work at all, you know, because you don't want to be setting that off.
And I've relied on physical work all my life. I mean, I left school at an early age. I ended up going to a stage 5 school. I was only could only take English and maths. You know, I'm not the smartest of people, don't get me wrong. I'm not stupid, but I relied on my strength for earning, yeah.
And then that strength was taken away from you. Yeah. So let's go to fast forward a bit to 2011. And this is 2 years ago, roughly now, mm-hmm. and your first encounter with these ATOS people.
Yeah. Well, I managed to get the bus down there.
Where was that?
At Brislington.
Right.
From Lawrence Weston to Brislington. I had to take 2 buses. She asked me loads of questions. I gave her answers, truthful answers.
Was this a doctor or a nurse? It was
a doctor, okay. Allegedly. I don't know who she was listening to, but I don't think she was listening to me, because every time she asked, you know, does your back hurt when you do this? I'd say, yeah. She must have been writing down, no. Can you walk for this amount of, you know, this distance? And I say, well, it's hurting now. You know, I've got a pain in my back, a constant pain in my back. And it goes into agonizing spasms if, you know, I upset the equilibrium. And she just wasn't taking any notice whatsoever.
So did you actually get to see what the ATOS lady had written about you?
Not then, no. It went until I went to my appeal, and they sent all the information through to me, and I sat down and read it in disbelief. I couldn't believe it.
So you think you'd been totally misrepresented, basically?
Can I be honest? I think that she wrote down what she wanted to write down. She definitely went writing down what I was telling her. Definitely. Because, you know, I can walk a mile, but in that mile I might have 5 or 6 agonizing spasms, and I'm in constant pain. I'm in pain sat here now. Yeah. I don't know where she was getting, you know, what she was listening to, but everything she was asking me and everything I was telling her, it wasn't going down on a piece of paper.
So would you recommend that people who've had one of these assessments would appeal, just so they can see what's been written about them?
Yeah, definitely.
And have you had any help with your appeal and this? Because of course it's something that for many people that might be a serious problem, even appealing, because they don't have necessarily the mental energy to cope with having a fight over it.
Yeah, I didn't have any help on this the first time. As I say, I went up to the appeal, and they weren't much help either. I asked the social, I asked the job centre, I asked the people from the appeal. I need help. This, you know, you're not helping me. I'm a worker. I want to work, but right at this precise moment now, I've got back problems. You know, and they just kicked me out, basically. They just didn't want to know. They just didn't want to listen.
I mean, what would you say, you know, for people listening, thinking, well, actually, this guy's exaggerating his problems, possibly, you know, like some people
I've got a 10-inch scar on my back going right up my spine. I'm in pain, constant pain, and it goes up to agony. I mean, if I can't exaggerate that. I mean, I've had 2 back operations. I'm not, you know, I'm not one of these weirdos that seems to have an operation done for no reason, right? I've worked all my life, and now I'm going to have to retrain. I'm going to have to, you know, I'm going to have to pull myself together, because this has been a real hit. I mean, I had a breakdown.
At what stage did that happen? Tell us about that.
Well, it was when I went for the appeal, and I realised that even they didn't want to help me, and I went back to the job centre because I was put back on income support. And it was the man in the job centre. He said, "Well," he said, "how do you expect me to help you? What do you want me to do?" And I said, "Like, well, I've been sent here, you know, because they're saying that I'm not eligible for employment support allowance, so I've got to come and sign on here." He said, "Well, Mr. Derek," he said, "you know, you can't lift anything, you can't bend, you can't walk for a great distance, you know, you can't sit for any long distance, for any long period of time. You know, what can we do for you?"
Well, there aren't a lot of jobs out there that you know will fit your bill for you. In fact, there probably are none.
Well, there's none that I know of. I mean, you know, and
so anyway, how did that affect you emotionally? I mean, obviously, you know,
I felt completely adrift. I was I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to turn to. I was getting angrier and angrier by the day. I was having arguments with the job centre. You know, my doctor was saying, "You're in no position to work. This is a man that I've been with for like 15, 16, 17 years. And you've got some woman from Atos in 20 minutes overruling him and just writing down what she wanted to write down." Because she wasn't writing down what I was telling her, unless she was blatantly calling me a liar, which that's what she's done. That's, you know, that's the end story. Is whatever I was saying to her, it didn't matter. I may as well have done it by post, because, well, she just wasn't taking any notice. And as you know yourself, is all to do, well, for me, I think is all to do with what the government can say in the Houses of Parliament, you know, with all their numbers and figures, and it's all wrong.
Okay, so how, when you say you had a breakdown, I mean, you know, if you don't mind talking about it, what happened? No.
It's still going on to this day, to tell the truth. I locked myself away. Felt really bad. I still do, you know, break down in tears. I'm fighting it back now, just thinking about what they've done to me.
Because, I mean, you've got this sense of anger, but it's very difficult to know where, of course, that to direct it. It's difficult.
Well, I was directing it at the job centre, and, you know, even the a man said to me, he said, "Listen, Mr. Derek," he said, "like, we're on your side, you know, we know what situation you're in, and we know that they've sent you back to us. We can't do nothing for you. The best thing to do for you to do is to appeal." And he sat down and wrote another appeal letter for me, and then he got me in contact with the benefit advice.
And, okay, so you're going through another appeal. Have you got a bit more help this time?
I've got more help this time. Yeah, yeah. And
so, who's that helping you?
A place called St Mungo's, which used to be called Novas, and the benefits advice as well. Two lots of people, and they're absolutely brilliant. That, you know, they say, I mean, nothing's a sure thing, but I've told them everything. I've told them my history and what I'm going through now. I mean, I'm still doing physiotherapy. I'm still going to physiotherapy. I've just started seeing a psychiatrist, like, do you know what I mean? Because I've been going through anxiety, panic attacks, and yeah, I've been a bit low. I've been very low over the last couple of years since stopping work, and I fell into a rut. But I asked for help, and they didn't seem to want to help. They just wanted to just get me in and out of, you know.
Okay, well, this appeal process, can you just explain? I mean, probably maybe will be people out there who might be thinking about appealing. I mean, you, obviously, for you, it's a bit of a help, because it means that you've got a second chance to appeal.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, with these people coming, who will come with me into the appeal room. You know, it was like the first time I went for the appeal. Now, there is a woman, there is two women on the tribunal or whatever, and I said to one of them, said, exercise with your back? How do you do things? I said, well, sometimes I'll go swimming. And she automatically turned around and said, oh, that's no good for you. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, I've got a bad back and swimming's no good for it. I said that. I told that to my doctor. He said, yeah, but what's the matter with her back? You know, it's not the same as your back. Or did you ask her that? I said, well, no. He said, well, you know, I told you, which he did, if any exercise, if it doesn't hurt you, do it. You know, and, you know, it's each individual has got their own different way of dealing with certain things. And it just so happened that she was trying to, you know, bring me into her bad back. Like, and I, as I said to her, well, as I should have said to her after, I didn't actually say it to her. But I mean, you know, in hindsight, it's a wonderful thing. You know, if I could turn back the clocks, there's a few choice sentences that I'd like to throw at her. Right?
Yeah. So you're in this. You know how? I mean, obviously, you've been through this kind of breakdown kind of thing. You're going to see a psychiatrist, but how are you feeling in yourself coming up to this second appeal? I mean, do you feel that it's that you may get some justice this time? And, you know, emotionally, are you able to you know, is it a positive thing for you?
I'm hoping. I mean, you know, but I'm more confident this time that I'll get a result that I need, because there'll be, you know, I'll have, you know, a bit of help with the legal side and the chatting to the doctor and that. But I really feel sorry for anyone who's got to go through the appeal on their own, because they just don't seem to listen. They just don't seem to listen.
But there is support out there. That's good to hear.
There is support out there, yeah.
Just remind us where you've managed to get this support from, if there are other people.
There's a place called St. Mungo's.
Yeah.
Used to be called Novas.
And where is that?
I think it's just off of Old Market. I hadn't actually been down there. He comes out and sees me. He's a floating support worker.
Okay.
And he's been absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And he's got another person in from the Benefit Advice, and he's been absolutely brilliant as well. And you know, that they're both I've listened to them, and they both give me loads of good advice.
Well, Matthew, it sounds to me like you're on the right track now, particularly now you've got a bit of support, because the worst thing about this for me, it's almost a bit fascistic the way that disabled people are being singled out and actually bullied by ATOS and lied about. Yeah. I mean, it's quite clear. I mean, I've come across several cases. I mean, just in my own personal people, friends of mine, for example, that have been lied about in these assessments by yeah. ATOS. So the ultimate thing here is, I mean, if you were, you know, in a meeting with Ian Duncan Smith, the Work and Pensions Minister, and someone from ATOS, what would you have to say to them now?
Well, I'd have to tell them to sort their to sort their act out, give help. You know, not just worry about their figures for, you know, here's what they read out in the Houses of Parliament.
I mean, because you do get the impression, don't you, that ATOS are just simply being paid to get people off of disability benefits.
That's very much so. That seems to be their rule. And I mean,
it's a bit like the work programme. I don't know, you know, one of the things about the work programme is a lot of people have been pushed on to being self-employed, even though they're not actually self-employed. They're mm-hmm. just doing, maybe selling something on eBay a couple of times a week, making 20 quid a week. Oh, well, that could be, you can be self-employed doing that. And of course, what many people don't realise is that figures of up to £15,000 change hand. So every time someone is shifted off of as long-term unemployment figures, will go to the work programme company, whoever they are. You know, it's large amounts of public money go to these firms when they get somebody off of those figures, if they can show that the person's been there for, I think it's 6 months or something. You know, there's a big financial incentive on these work programme companies. I'm not talking about ATOS now. To get people off of the unemployment figures. And, of course, this is one of the reasons that the government is saying, oh, yes, the figures are looking good. Anyway, Matthew, a final word from you. What advice have you got out for people who are having trouble with these ATOS assessments out there?
There is help and there is support out there. I must admit, the first time I went to the Atos thing over in Brisbane, and she was asking me, can you do this, can you do that, can you bend, I was in the kind of mind frame that she was there to help me, but it turned out that she wasn't. And the same with the appeal. I thought the appeal was, you know, they were going to listen to me, and they just didn't. It just seems that it's just a government run to get their own figures down, and it it's very, very upsetting, and it can cause extreme stress and extreme worry, because it's like you're on your own, and you know, no one wants to be on their own. No one wants to be fighting a government organisation on your own. Like, you just can't do it. But there is help out there. There are people out there that know the system. And, you know, and I'd definitely go and search them out.
Okay, Matthew Derrick from Lawrence Weston, thanks very much for coming in on Dalek today.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Santana and Primera there. I'm guessing that was early 1980s. Not absolutely sure. Right, well, I'm joined by Paul Fernie now again. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Tony.
The
okay.
Moon, the moon this week. We've had a full moon pretty much. I think, is it this week when the full moon was?
Yeah, it's this week. I don't think it's actually quite got to full yet. I think you'll find it's full in the next day or so.
Okay, the cycle of the moon, 29 days.
Yeah, it's 29 days and a few hours, which is why, you know, when you see the full moon, you see the different phases, it sort of shifts through the month as the year goes by.
Now, what's so special about when the moon is full?
Well, when the moon's full, people... it's often conceived that we see sort of 50% of the moon because it's fixed in a it's fixed gravitationally, so we always see the same face. But we actually see 59% of the moon. This is due to something called libration, which is where the moon twists very slightly. So it's not actually 50%. We don't just see.
So the dark side of the moon is not always dark. It's a little bit gets. There's a little bit of shade goes in there from time to time.
Yeah, to say there's a dark side of the moon isn't actually true because, as obviously, because the moon's fixed gravitationally, as it becomes new, the rear of the moon's actually illuminated by the sun.
See, this is the very special thing about the moon, isn't it? Again, another special thing. We were talking about these things the other week, where it's fixed, so there's always the same face. Facing towards the Earth. How on Earth does that happen?
That's happened purely because of the gravitational forces acting on the moon by the Earth and the Sun.
Most other moons, for example, I mean, they're spinning away, aren't they, around Jupiter and places like that?
No, most moons are sort of gravitationally fixed. However, you know, depending on where they are positioned from the planet and the position, the exact position sort of in relation to the gravitational fields.
Well, I mean, hang on, though, because surely the Earth is going around the Sun. Surely the Earth should be fixed by the Sun and shouldn't be spinning away.
We could go really into detail here, Tony, because I've actually seen some stuff online about the moon moving away from the Earth and what perspective you'd see. You'd see the Earth moving away from the moon if you're on the moon, but that's not actually the case.
So generally moons don't spin, whereas planets do?
Yes.
Okay. What about the dark side then? What's over there?
The dark side is has been photographed quite extensively over the years. It's mainly craters, really, because obviously, you know, as we discussed last week, there's a lot of stuff out in space that's sort of heading towards us. And in a way, we've got the moon to thank for the fact that the Earth's here, really, because a lot of those meteorites, if the moon wasn't there, would probably hit the Earth, whereas because of the gravitational effect.
But there's not much gravity on the moon, surely. These meteorites aren't sucked into the moon because there's hardly any gravity there.
Yeah, but the gravity that the Earth forces on the moon keeps it in its orbit. Basically, the moon acts as almost like a sentinel for the Earth and sort of protects it from a lot of incoming debris.
Well, sounds like a bit of luck if a bit of debris. Well, I'll take your word for it anyway. What about, and we're at Easter now as well. What's the connection between Easter and the moon? I know it's part of the Jewish Passover is fixed on. Is that right?
Yeah. Easter basically is calculated, is usually the first Sunday after the first full moon after the spring equinox. Now, the equinox was last Friday. The equinox being the point when the Earth is halfway, a quarter way through its travel around the Sun. And it's also the point when the Sun rises directly over the equator.
So the equinox is halfway between the mid-winter point, where we're furthest away from the Sun, and the midsummer point where we're closest, I guess.
Yeah, actually, that's a misconception, Tony. Because the Earth's actually at perigee, which is its closest pass to the Sun during our winter, and is its furthest from the Sun during our summer. It's sort of a bit of a just to assume that. In winter,
all right. So we'll say the highest in the sky is in the middle of summer, and the lowest in the sky is the middle of winter, and it's halfway between those two.
It's halfway between those two points. Yeah.
Okay. So is it easy to fix when Easter's going to be, or is it a little bit of guesswork?
There is a bit of guesswork. I mean, really. Religiously speaking, the moon still has quite a part to play in a lot of religions. In particular, in the Middle East, the new month is determined by a sighting of the new moon, basically, which you can sight the new moon roughly anything from sort of 12 to 18 hours after it passes new, as when the old moon basically becomes the new moon. And still some religions, particularly in the Middle East, focus on that date. So Easter is, you know, the moon has a huge part to play in human life, and often it's not actually given the credit it's given.
Well, it affects the tides, doesn't it? We know that. But, I mean, it may affect people, I suppose. I mean, this is getting a little bit almost into the world of astrology, isn't it?
I wouldn't say astrology, but, I mean, there's a lot of reports out there, particularly a lot of police forces in this country say the full moon is their busiest time of the month.
Right.
And also, you know, ladies' cycles are very closely linked to the cycle of the moon still.
Well, yeah, but the thing is that not all women are on their same exact cycle, are they? They're
no,
kind
they're
of
not.
Spread out.
But it's
they?
Roughly the same amount of time, 29 or so days. I'm not a biologist, though, so please don't quote me on
okay,
that.
Okay, so is there any real connection between humans and the moon, or is this a little bit like astrology?
No, I believe that the moon does have an effect on
isn't
us.
Isn't it lunatics that were called the yep. lunar, and that this was something, you know, for centuries that people have said, well, you know, this is a difficult time. So what time should you, you know, look out for people behaving a bit peculiar?
Any time around about the next few days, really.
Okay.
It's the best time to look out for people acting a bit peculiar.
Okay. Well, Paul Fernie, thanks very much. Fascinating.
Thanks, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Jason Yiannakopoulos. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
All right, what have you got for us this week? You've been going through Private Eye again, haven't you?
I certainly have. There's a very nice and interesting story in this.
Okay, this is about some guy, Subhasharan Al-Raja. Now, he's not the sort of name you trips off the tongue you would expect to be a Conservative Party donor.
No, but he has given £426,000 to the Conservative Party.
That's nearly £500,000, Jason.
That is nearly
£500,000. That's quite a lot of money, isn't it? So you can run quite a lot of Conservative central office using that.
Yeah, he's the owner of Leica Mobile. Now, the interesting thing about this is the last available figures for Leica Mobile, which is itself part of Leica Telecom, which is another company he owns, shows a £320 million turnover, £16 million worth of profit, but no tax.
No tax? Hang on. If they're making profit, surely they've got to be taxed on it. Am I being naive?
Well, it's although it is based in Portugal, it's based in Madeira, which is a Portugal island, and it's actually got tax haven status.
Oh, Madeira. I wonder Madeira. If they sips Madeira at the little meetings they have with the rather nice wine, actually, fortified wine. So that's how much money again? Let's just remind ourselves how much of the tax that's not being paid is instead going into Tory central office.
Well, the amount he gave was £426,000.
Incredible. Right, you know, he's based in Portugal, which is having a bit of a rough time with the euro, but not as rough as Cyprus. Now, in fact, it's not about all of Cyprus, is it? It's Greek Cyprus. So, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, you know, you've got a bit of Greek ancestry as well, Jason. So, what, you know, if you were in Cyprus now, would you
Greek.
Be yeah. would you be annoyed?
Marginally, you know. It's... I'll be marginally annoyed because it is a really tough. It's a really tough package what they've got. You know,
I mean, it's unprecedented. This is the thing that everyone seems to be saying, is that they've not had a euro settlement that has actually, part of the agreement has been we're actually taking slices out of everybody's bank account. I think isn't it 10% of everybody's bank account, or 30 or 40% of everybody who's got over £100,000. Now, that means, surely, you know, if you're running a business and you need a lot of money in your business bank account, or is it just individual bank accounts? Maybe you've made a lot of money. I mean, I think it's business bank accounts too. That actually means that you won't be able to pay your staff, doesn't it?
That is a massive issue in Cyprus. I mean, yeah, it's a deal, and a lot of people have criticised it. Some people support it. I think it's a massively tough deal, but I was aware of the situation Cyprus was in, but they were quite deep in it because of their links to the Greek banks. But it's interesting that Cyprus have got a pretty much what might be a big bailout, but slightly tougher than the one Greece got, which is intriguing. I know Russia is absolutely, the Russian minister is absolutely mad at this because, of course, some of that money belongs to Russian millionaires. So.
Right. What about the political angle to it? Because it seems to be mostly being driven by the Germans. They seem to be in charge.
Yes.
And this is the Greeks versus the Germans again. I know there was a little bit of...
We've been there before.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Is it, you know, is there actually a bit of nationalism involved in all this and the
well,
Germans lording it over the Greeks?
Well, the Greeks... Greece should never have been part of the Euro. It never had a stable enough economy.
Yeah, but it is.
It is.
You can't rewrite history.
Yeah, we were given... Greece was given that chance, and maybe it's a bad thing. Maybe it is a bit of Germany lording it over other countries, because it's not just Greece either. It's also Spain, Italy, Portugal, Ireland, you know. I think it's a pigs group, as they call it. Portugal, Ireland, Greece and Spain.
We've also heard the BRICS countries. That's Brazil, Russia... India and
China.
South Africa and China are all now saying, well, what we need is to replace the IMF. Now, what are your thoughts about that?
It's a
because the IMF is part of this troika, yeah. Isn't it? That's making these bailout settlements with
it's,
Cyprus.
It's a brave move. I mean, the biggest danger of that is that the whole world economy collapses and we end up with World War III, and we don't want that.
Well, I mean, what's this? I mean, because I mean, you don't necessarily think that an economic problem is also a war problem. What's the connection?
Well, the connection is that some countries may money to other countries, you know, debts unpaid. Banking is international, of course, nowadays. So.
It's a little bit like the loan shark. When you don't pay the debt back, comes banging on the door, don't they? Maybe even puts an axe through the door or something like that.
Yeah. It's interesting, because on Mock the Week recently, they had an analyst talking about how what we need, what's ideal now for the economy is a Europe and Eurozone run by the Germans, to which I think the response was, because of course we've never had that, we've never tried that before.
Okay, Jason, thanks very much. More from Private Eye, I hope, next week.
Yeah.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Joined by Jeff Sparks. Hi, Jeff, and welcome to Dialect.
Hello, Tony.
I don't really need to welcome you. You're here most weeks, aren't you? So
yes.
Welcome again.
Thank you.
What have we got for us this week?
Well, starting with Friday, 29th of March, the Beatles tribute, VW Beatles, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol, Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Cloven Hoof. This group formed in Wolverhampton in 1979, and split up in 1990 before reforming in 2000, and still performing and recording to this day. In their career, they have released 4 studio albums, 2 EPs, 1 live album, and a compilation album. This is from the album Sultan's Ransom, which was released in 1989, and it's the song Highlander.
My destiny.
That was Clovenhoof with Highlander from the album Sultan's Ransom. For more information on them, you can check out www.clovenhoof.co.uk. Until Saturday, 30th of March, Fueled by Cider presents the West Country Invasion, which features Skimmity Hitchers, Surfing Turnips, the Inbreds, the Shin Kickers, and DJ Dapper Dan at the Thunderbolt on Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 31st of March, Pete Coggins and the Soul Ingredients will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door and the gig starts at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Now, I'm afraid it's time to sign off. And because we had such an interesting interview with Matthew Derrick, which was supposed to be 20 minutes and it went on for nearly half an hour because it was a terrible situation. He's had a disabled chap with the ATOS assessments and also with his horrible injury. He had workplace injury with his company sacking him just before he had a chance to take them to court over it. So no Alan Frankovich this week. I did announce it at the beginning. Well, promise you we'll have some from Alan Frankovich, the US filmmaker, made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. We'll have some of that. That's called The Maltese Double Cross, by the way, next week. So that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download the weekly podcast from dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks very much to our studio guests. That is Paul Fernie and Matthew Derrick and, of course, Jason Yannakopoulos. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye.
And he looks at her and says, "Hey, darling, I can remember when you could stop a cloud. Oh, but ain't that America for you and me? Ain't that America something to see, baby? Ain't that America home of the free? Yeah, little pink houses for you and me. Oh, yeah." Everything else, those old crazy dreams just kinda came away. man, baby, pays the thrills, the bills, the pills that kill.